Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. We hope your long weekend was... We hope you made the most of it. Let's put it that way. However it unfolded in your world. We have an interesting show here for you today. We made it to the Hopcat in East Lansing over the weekend, and it was fun and interesting, and we are scheduled to talk with Mark Sellers, the owner of the Hopcat in East Lansing. We update Right to Work with John Beck of Michigan State University, and we hope you can stay close. More than 100,000 people have been killed, and nearly a quarter of Syria's population has been displaced since the uprising against President Bashar al-Assad began back in March of 2011. While the Obama administration, up until this point, has largely avoided any direct involvement in the conflict, the administration claims on August 21st a chemical weapons attack left 1,400 civilians dead, and they claim it was the work of Assad's forces. Calling the use of chemical weapons, quote, a red line, President Obama has asked for congressional approval for a U.S. military strike. Here with us now to sort out this very complex situation in Syria is Mohammed Ayoub. He is a Michigan State University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of International Relations and the author of the newly released book out this week, Assessing the War on Terror. He also has a book coming out in February with the title, Will the Middle East Implode? Welcome to Current State, Dr. Ayoub. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
What do you make of President Obama's decision to seek congressional approval for an attack?
I think the president was caught in a bind because it's obvious that domestic public opinion is not terribly enthusiastic about engaging in another warlike enterprise in the Middle East after having been caught in Iraq and Afghanistan, suffered losses not merely in terms of human lives, but also in terms of American credibility and popularity in the region in particular, but the world in general. So I think the decision to go to the Congress was, in a way, was the result of two things. One, Obama's fundamental indecisiveness about this issue. I think he got caught in a bind because he had made a statement a year ago or so about the use of chemical weapons being a red line, and now he is being forced to deliver on his warning that he had made. The other is that he is very ambivalent about doing this, even at this stage, it seems, and wants to cover his back by getting the Congress to approve so that in case things go wrong or the attack doesn't meet its objectives or it creates a greater mess, which it is most likely to do, that he could share the blame with the Congress and not have to take total responsibility for it.
Why would an attack, in your view, likely lead to a greater mess?
Well, because I think for two reasons. One, I do not think it's going to make a fundamental difference in terms of the actual state of play in Syria on the ground, unless it goes beyond merely a cruise missile attack, and it's a sustained one that takes out many of the military assets of the Assad regime. That might change the situation. But I don't think they're contemplating an attack of that sort. So if it's merely going to be a pinprick, the negative political fallouts from there are probably going to be much more than the positive military outcome. It's going to once again raise the temperature in the Middle East of anti-Americanism. It's the third or fourth time that in the last decade the United States will be engaging in warlike activity in one of the Muslim countries. I mean, not many people in the Muslim world are particularly fond of Bashar al-Assad. But once there's an external intervention by a major power, and given the fact that American credibility is very low in the Muslim world, it might turn that opinion around. So that would be one of the negative fallouts. The other would be what's politely called collateral damage, which means there are civilian casualties that far exceed the military import of that attack. And that might create a hue and cry. In fact, it may actually, if one could see a scenario where it actually becomes counterproductive, because it raises the sympathy level for the Assad regime within the Middle East to not amongst regimes, but amongst the what's called the Arab street or the Arab population, to an extent that it turns population, it turns popular opinion against the United States, against the opponents of the regime, and in fact, in favor of the Assad regime. So there are all sorts of consequences that might follow.
What is the best path forward, though? There doesn't appear to be many options here.
No, there isn't a good path forward. I mean, the choice is between the worst and the worst, probably, I mean, if one can put it that way. But Syria is a very complex issue. I mean, what started as a democracy movement turned into an insurgency, and then thanks to external assistance to this insurgency, it's become a full-fledged civil war. But what's even more important is that it is no longer merely a domestic Syrian affair. There is more than one proxy war that is being fought in Syria. There is the proxy war between Saudi Arabia, which supports with its other allies in the Gulf, and Turkey supports the opposition to the Assad regime, and Iran, which is one of the principal supporters of the Assad regime. Iran and Saudi Arabia are the two principal contestants for preeminence in the energy-rich Persian Gulf region. And this is one way for Saudi Arabia to keep Iran bogged down in the Fertile Crescent so that it depletes its diplomatic and political capabilities that it could exercise or use in the Persian Gulf. So there is that Cold War that's going on. The Saudis obviously are not particularly interested in democracy promotion, given their own system and the fact that they have only recently used what in American terms would be called boots on the ground by sending in forces into Bahrain to crush Bahrain is next door to Saudi Arabia, to crush the democracy movement there, to help the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain crush the democracy movement there. They are in Syria primarily to teach Iran a lesson. The other proxy war that's being fought, and it's connected with the one that I just talked about, is the proxy war between the United States and Iran. Because of the tension between Tehran and Washington over the issue of Iran's nuclear enrichment aspirations, but it goes much beyond that as well. The United States or certain segments of American policymakers are interested in teaching Iran a lesson as well. And I think that's probably the primary reason why the United States has become involved in Syria. I mean, there are obviously humanitarian and other grounds, but the United States has been involved clandestinely in supporting the insurgency, in supporting the rebels for the past year and a half, and that's been no secret. CIA does have boots on the ground, probably in Syria, but certainly on Syria's border with Turkey.
We're talking with Dr. Mohammed Ayoub, MSU Professor of International Relations, about the Syrian debate. Let's talk about two countries here with apparently quite different opinions on how to go forward, and two of our bigger allies. Britain's decision not to participate, but the French support of military action. What are we to make of that?
Well, it's interesting. It's sort of a reversal in roles, because if you remember Iraq,
exactly,
France had opposed the intervention, the American and Allied intervention in Iraq, whereas Britain was the most enthusiastic supporter, the cheerleader. In fact, Blair had put himself out on a limb so much that British public opinion had started to call him Bush's poodle. If you remember that term.
Sure.
And this time the rules have, as I said, have been reversed. David Cameron did want to go into the war, just like Blair did with Iraq, but his parliament voted it down. And it's very interesting that this should have happened, because in a parliamentary system that Britain has, unlike the presidential system in the United States, the prime minister and cabinet have a majority in parliament. Otherwise, they would not be the government of the country. But despite the fact that the government had the backing of a majority in parliament, the House of Commons turned down its request for a proposal to go to war or to join the United States in this endeavor against Syria, which is really a slap in the face for David Cameron. But he apparently has a very strong hide. Any other person in his place would have probably sent in his resignation to the Queen, because it amounted almost to a vote of no confidence in the government on such an important issue.
What's been the larger general response from other world countries?
I think, well, we have seen the Russian response, which is highly negative, very critical, in fact, rudely so, in some of President Putin's statements. We have seen the Iranian reaction, which is equally critical. In fact, some segments of the Iranian military elite have talked about retaliation and so on and so forth. On the other hand, there are regimes in the Arab world like Saudi Arabia, who have very enthusiastically supported this move, despite the fact that there are critics within this country itself that have said, well, if the Saudis are that excited about the endeavor, why don't they go in and do it themselves? Because they have much of the technology, weapons technology and weapons, top-of-the-line weapons, that have been supplied to them by the United States. But the Saudis are not prone to taking chances and are very conservative on that. And I think I'm not even sure if they're able to operate fully all the top-of-the-line weapons that the United States has supplied to them. Turkey has been very enthusiastic about it, but not just enthusiastic. In fact, the Prime Minister of Turkey has expressed his reservation, in a sense that he feels that the United States should have been doing much more, that the objective of an American military intervention in Syria would really be to bring down the Assad regime and not merely give it a pinprick on this particular issue chemical weapons.
U.S. credibility took a hit in the aftermath of the Iraq war. It still suffers in some areas. How would you assess our credibility on this front right now?
Well, the Iraq war, and I mentioned this earlier as well, the Iraq war has done a great disservice as far as American credibility is concerned, particularly the credibility of the intelligence on the basis of which the Bush administration decided to go to war, despite the fact that it did not have United Nations approval. As it turned out, much of that intelligence was manufactured, if you want to call it that, in the back rooms of the Defense Department by a certain cabal that was interested in this venture, in bringing down, not merely bringing down the Saddam regime, but in debilitating Iraqi military, the residual Iraqi military capabilities after the 1991 war. And when it came out, and Hans Blix, who was then the head of the UN inspection team, was against it. Mohammed al-Baradei, the head of the director general of the IAEA, had gone on record to say that he did not believe that Iraq had any nuclear weapons. But despite all that, Colin Powell went to the Security Council, and it was one of the, and he later regretted that he made that speech, that he appeared before the Security Council and presented evidence that was obviously manufactured and did not correspond to the reality on the ground.
But where does that correspond with today?
Well, today, when the United States administration says that the Syrian government has used chemical weapons, people say, ha, well, that's what they said about Iraq, that Iraq had nuclear weapons. So why should we believe them?
So there is still doubt.
Oh, yes.
Are you suggesting that doing nothing may be as constructive as taking action?
I would think so. I think this may also be the beginning of going down a slippery slope on Syria. And that the United States, once it's taken action and it hasn't achieved the objective that it thought it was going to achieve, which means that if Assad uses these weapons once again, the United States may be forced to go in down the road where having boots, even putting boots on the ground, may have to be seriously considered, which American public opinion, I'm sure, would not approve of. And then if at that point the United States backs down, its credibility will take an even greater hit.
We are out of time. I wish we had longer. Mohammed Ayoub is a Michigan State University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of International Relations and the author of the upcoming book, Will the Middle East Implode?, which comes out in February. His new book coming out this week. I scribbled it down and lost it. No, it's here. It's called Assessing the War on Terror. Look for that as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Water attracted early settlers to Detroit, and water fueled its growth. Now it's an important asset to the city's recovery. Today, Current State continues to explore Detroit's waterfront, challenges and opportunities in our series, Detroit Water Renaissance. Last week, we looked at the unearthing of Detroit streams. Today, we explore efforts to re-engineer the Detroit River's concrete shoreline. Detroit's not exactly known for its natural waterfront. The Detroit River is 32 miles long on the U.S. side, and of those 32 miles, just 1 mile is still undeveloped wetland. But in recent years, the river's been undergoing a pretty remarkable transition. Industrial sites are being cleaned up and re-engineered into habitats for wildlife. And one visionary wildlife manager is pushing for what's called soft shorelines all up and down the river. But the project is an uphill battle against environmental contamination and a lack of funding. For WKAR and Great Lakes Echo, reporter Lewis Wallace takes us on a tour.
It's 8 a.m., and I'm at the Humbug Marsh in Trenton, downriver from Detroit. That's the mythical mile of the Detroit River that was never paved. It smells like burning plastic from a chemical plant next door. But down in the Humbug Woods, longtime downriver resident Mickey Widener stops to eavesdrop on a birdwatching tour. And he puts things in context.
I remember going past Wyandotte, the city I live in, and the water was white. You'd go past Great Lake Steele, and the water was orange.
He says a lot has changed along the Detroit River.
You know, my ride here down Jefferson, it's heavy, heavy, heavy industrial. Now it's like driving down a country road.
At least some of that is thanks to the man who's my guide for the day.
My name is John Hartig, and I'm the refuge manager for the Detroit River International Wildlife Refuge.
Hartig's been working to restore natural habitats all up and down the Detroit River, starting right here with the Humbug Marsh. He was instrumental in creating the first ever international wildlife refuge, along with the Canadian government, in 2001. Humbug is the centerpiece, and the refuge adopts more land all the time. Hartig's passionate about the project.
What we're doing with birds and fish and outdoor recreation is really part of a bigger strategy to make a city sustainable and livable.
And Hartig's not just about preservation. He's about rebuilding, which is where soft shoreline engineering comes in. Basically, they take out cement and steel along the water and put in rocks and native species in their place.
So let's just go right over here.
We cross a scraggly-looking field.
You can just see how we're walking down towards the water now. You get the, and these are species of native trees. What we've done is created some underwater habitat of rocks that are of varying sizes.
Honestly, it doesn't look like much. Rocks and mud and a few plants. But Hartig says this soft shoreline is a haven for fish and wetland wildlife returning to the river.
Think about it from an invertebrate perspective. Engineers wanted everything straight lines, and we want some what we call sinuosity, you know, some undulation.
And he says it's cheaper to build, too, than hard shorelines. Hartig says the price tag for a soft shoreline can be a fraction of the cost of cement and steel pilings. He's worked on more than 50 soft shoreline projects in the Detroit area, and a couple new projects get added to his docket every year.
Listen.
So we continue on up the river to another.
It used to be called Slocum's Island, and now it's called Elizabeth Park.
And another.
The Black Lagoon.
So named because a few years ago they dug down underwater to test the soils and...
In the middle of the sediments was a big band of nothing but oil and grease.
Capping the contamination and building a soft shoreline has taken years. And it becomes increasingly clear, the further we get from humbug, that it's not all frogs and marshes in the Detroit River. There are some pretty serious obstacles to restoring wetlands here. Just this two-county area has more than 400 contaminated industrial sites. Hartig says, sure.
We are the Rust Belt, as they say. And so we have had huge, heavy industry here. Some of it's gone, but some of it still remains.
And then there's the constant fundraising. Most of the money for Hartig's projects is federal, and there's private funding, but it's still never enough. It took 9 years just to clean up the site for a planned visitor center for the refuge. It was expected to be completed years ago, but funding problems are no surprise in this region. Southeast Michigan has suffered from the loss of industry, and Detroit has been on the verge of a financial meltdown for a long time. In recent years, hundreds of city parks have closed due to budget cuts. Faye Nelson heads the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy, the nonprofit that manages 5.5 miles of the Detroit shoreline, where Hartig also has soft shore projects. I ask how they justify their focus on the riverfront when there are so many unmet needs.
So this just isn't a waterfront that's used by, you know, workers that are downtown. This waterfront is utilized by the community throughout the region.
And she says there's an economic angle, too.
It provides a huge benefit beyond quality of life that is already bringing major dollars, a major economic return to our community, and we've only just begun.
But those benefits aren't reaching everywhere. It just takes a drive up to Detroit through about 25 miles of factories and burned-out homes to see that. I stop off at a place called Riverside Park, and there's a big sign at the entrance, closed due to environmental contamination. And get this, this closed park is chock full of people out fishing. Detroiters Ruth and Ronnie Williams say Riverside isn't how it used to be.
Well, we used to have swings and bathrooms here, but they ain't got them no more. I used to bring my grandkids and my kids down here all the time.
They closed this park down, then they closed a couple more down. We got everybody piled into one place now.
Piled in is right. People are jammed in here. And that's just it. This place doesn't have the forward progress feeling of all Hartig's shoreline projects. But still, people really want to spend their Saturday on this river. Enough to hang out in a contaminated park. One fisherman I talked to has lived in Detroit his whole life. And now he's retired. He says, yeah, the change along the Detroit River is slow and it's uneven. But he'll take what he can get.
Wouldn't it be terrible if your children had to only see animals in cages or in zoos and petting zoos and never have to see nothing in a while like it was intended? Because of human beings, we've dredged all the lakes and rivers and we've built on everything and there's no space left for them. I mean, it would be a shame if you come down here one day and all this water was gone. There was nothing out there but muddy bottom and a bunch of rocks and trash.
For WKAR and Great Lakes Echo, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Detroit winter.
And the series Detroit Water Renaissance is produced by Current State and Great Lakes Echo with support from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Next week in our series, we take a look at Detroit's multi-billion dollar fishing industry. Around face them, run to the ground ancient. Ruins of a metropolis, not a populace. Shrinking ink and deals to build as if the town's vacant. Every empty lot remaining a profound statement. Every empty bottle claiming all the jobs. Yesterday was the first Labor Day in Michigan since right to work legislation was signed into law. Joining us now to talk about organized labor, especially post right to work, is John Beck. He's the Associate Director of the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. Welcome, John.
Great, thanks. Nice to be here.
About half of the United States now are right-to-work states, mostly in the South and out West. And we keep hearing that data is either hard to come by or not conclusive or both. What in your best opinion, what's your best thinking here as to the result of right-to-work legislation in other states?
Well, I guess that, first of all, you have to remember that many of those have been right-to-work states since the late 1940s, when right-to-work was first allowed under labor law. Maybe a little bit of clarification just for your listeners. The way right-to-work came into being is in 1947 under Taft-Hartley, which was the first set of amendments to the National Labor Relations Act, which was passed in 1935, the Wagner Act. It was allowed for the first time for there to be state-by-state option on allowing what was called right-to-work, where members of labor unions could give up their membership and still be covered by a union contract in mostly private sector employment, because at that time, the 1947 Act, just like the 1935 Act, only extended to private sector workers. So in that way, it allowed members to not be members but still get everything that a member received in the same workplace. So often that's why unions have called it the right to work for less, or, you know, it's a modification of this whole notion of a union shop, where you've got 100% of people covered and 100% of people paying dues to be members of the union. So many of the states that were early right-to-work states already were anti-labor states at the time of the passage in 1947. South Carolina, which, you know, has only single-digit unionization compared to here in Michigan, where we're even now, later in the early part of the 21st century, in double-digit unionization rates compared to other states. So it it's a real toss-up, you know, once you start talking about it, because the fact that so much is different from place to place, history of the specific states, the range of industries, public sector employment, whether or not public sector unionization is allowed under state law. There's a lot of kind of nuances to all of that.
Is this unresolved quality here about the impact of right to work? Is that going to linger for a long time?
Well, here in Michigan especially it is, for a number of reasons. First thing to keep in mind about the passage of right to work here in Michigan is that right to work by its very nature is really staggered into existence based on when contracts become open. When a contract is, if people are currently under contract, they are still covered under the old contractual provisions of, say, mandatory union membership in a union shop, until the new contract is open and is being bargained. At that time, it's illegal to demand a union shop here in Michigan, as normally would have been the case prior to right to work. So some of those contracts don't come due for years to come now. And there was a spate of quick reopeners and renegotiation of contracts to lock in right to work union shop kind of language for years to come, in some cases, you know, 4 or 5, perhaps even longer years, depending on the specific workplace and specific contract. So in that way, the actual effect of the law will not be felt in Michigan for some time for a number of different employees in the state.
Well, what does the union community in general think about this trend? We became, I believe, the 24th state in the country to enact right to work. Does the union community in general feel that this is a trend that's going to continue? Are there battle line states here?
Well, naturally, there are other states that have reputations now as being fairly contested states. The one that comes to mind is the state of Wisconsin, which under Governor Walker had a number of anti-labor bills that were passed and signed into law there. So I think that people might look for Wisconsin or others. But it's not like there is this continuing trend. Every few years, one comes up. Indiana was the one, I believe, right before us. So I think that the way to think about organized labor's response to right to work, first is to look at the actual basis of the legislation. So here in Michigan, often people talked about it as somehow that this was going to enhance productivity or make it kind of a destination state for economic development mm-hmm. if it was passed. I think that that kind of notion is normally regarded by members of organized labor as kind of a slap because of the fact that there is no consonance between that economic development goes only to those, for example, right-to-work states. Some of the richest states in the nation, California, New York, and others, are still vibrant union security states compared to right-to-work states like South Carolina or Alabama, Mississippi, and the rest. So that the notion that somehow the floodgates of economic development were going to open, I think that organized labor found that to be kind of a sham here in the state as an argument for right-to-work. Right-to-work is by its very nature simply a union-weakening piece of legislation. So in that way, if you think that to get economic development you must have really weak unions in the state, then it might make sense. But in reality, unions can actually be a strong engine of productivity, a strong engine of kind of a good economy. And so the idea that somehow what we really need is weak unions, and this will translate suddenly into Michigan bouncing back dramatically in relation to economic development, I think a lot of people just were quite put off by that whole notion.
I've seen reports, and others have as well, I'm sure you have as well, reports of a greater number of jobs, but most of those jobs not comparable in terms of salary.
Right.
Is that still one of the larger forces that's in play here?
Well, and see, the problem is it's hard to come up with general causality about how this specific provision links to other things. You know, in reality, we've seen a general downsizing of, for example, the overall wage here in Michigan. Even with levels of unionization still being high, real wages that people are getting have fallen dramatically since 1982. The rise of more and more service sector jobs that are not necessarily as well paid as the original manufacturing base that we had here in Michigan. So trying to somehow draw a direct line correlation, you know, that right to work equals this, or, you know, that there's a linear progression in terms of how either what brings it on or what comes out of it is another question. All we do know, I think the thing that you can, you know, take to the bank is by its very nature, it's meant to be a union weakening provision. And part of that union weakening was not only about the unions being weakened in relation to the workplace, but unions being weakened in relation to political might when it comes to putting money in through PACs into candidates here in the state of Michigan. And I think especially this was meant to be a direct slap at the Michigan Education Association, the federal, state, county, municipal employees union, and other public sector workers, because they were regarded as extremely strong here in Michigan by comparison.
John Beck is the Associate Director of the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. John, thanks very much. On August 20th, the TV network known as Current became Al Jazeera America. The network, owned by the government of Qatar, bought Current for about $500 million. One of the Al Jazeera America domestic news bureaus is in Detroit, which has been placed in the hands of former WDIV reporter B.C. Onalieri. Current state Scott Pohl spoke with her about the challenge of launching a news bureau for a foreign-owned television network in the Motor City. She says Detroit's bankruptcy and the mayor's race will not be the only stories she'll cover.
Detroit is very, very unique right now in that this bankruptcy filing is attracting a lot of national attention. But it's not just, my focus just isn't here on Detroit. My focus is also on parts of Ohio, parts of Indiana and Pennsylvania. So you mentioned the whole mayoral race in Detroit. That hasn't so much gotten a lot of interest so far from the folks, from the headquarters. But I think it's a very interesting race, and I'm definitely keeping a close eye on what's going on.
Well, having covered Detroit for local television, WDIV, I wanted to ask you about the differences that you might be seeing in covering Detroit for local television as opposed to coverage for a nationwide network. So it sounds to me like your work will be a bit more regional than it was when you were covering the city of Detroit. Would that be right?
Right, yes. A bigger area to cover at this point. One thing that I think that I'll have an opportunity to do a little bit more of compared to when I was doing local news is that AJAM, which is the nickname, they're really into storytelling from the community's perspective. And so I feel like I'll have an opportunity to do more of those types of stories, stories from the people, by the people, if that makes any sense.
Human interest stories?
Human interest, yes. More how a story on a national scale may impact, you know, someone from Detroit's, living on Detroit's east side.
If your area of coverage goes into northern Ohio and northern Indiana, does that mean time on the road, for instance, occasionally when a story calls for that?
Yes, that's my understanding is that, yeah, I will be logging a lot of time on the road. The furthest that I've been so far, I've just started a couple weeks ago with the network, but the furthest I've been so far was Kalamazoo. I was there to cover an Occupy protest.
So maybe we'll see you in Lansing sometime.
Oh, yeah, I'll be all over Grand Rapids, Flint, wherever the big story is of the day, I'll be there.
How big is the Al Jazeera America Detroit Bureau? I guess I'm curious about your office space, studio space, what kind of equipment you have, how big the personnel staff is in Detroit. Can you shed some light on that for me?
Sure. We are going to be headquartered in the Guardian Building in downtown Detroit. We'll be on the 38th floor. Right now, we're still in the process of moving in, but there will be an office space there as well as a studio. When it comes to staff, as it stands right now, it's myself. There's a producer, and there's also a photojournalist as well. But there's definitely room in that office for growth. So I imagine as time goes on that there will be more people added to staff.
And in the current journalistic atmosphere, the resume machines are going to start cranking up as soon as people hear that, I suspect.
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, it's really an exciting time. When it comes to, you asked about technology or equipment. We have, the photographer has all of the lighting equipment and the cameras and the editing equipment off the computers. There will be, as you mentioned, there will be a studio there in the office with the camera set up as well. But yeah, that's basically what I know right now.
You mentioned the story that you've worked on in Kalamazoo. Can you give me one or two other examples of stories that you have already packaged for Al Jazeera America or that you're working on now?
Yes. I've done a couple pieces. Most recently, I did a piece on the Heidelberg Project, the outdoor art display on Detroit's east side. I also did a story as well talking about Detroit's bankruptcy, but in light of that, there are new businesses popping up in the city. So I profiled the Shinola Watch and Bike Factory in the New Center area in Detroit. And right now, I'm trying to address, I'm working on a story about the stray dog issue in Detroit. And I'm also looking into a new healthcare initiative that the big three automakers are trying out.
I wanted to ask you how your former colleagues and friends and family have responded to this move in your career going to work for Al Jazeera America. What are you hearing from the people around you?
You know, I've gotten a lot of support, both with my former colleagues and with my family and friends. Many times people, you know, they will ask me questions about Al Jazeera. Some people said, oh, it's scary, or, you know, they have questions about, you know, the negative perception that the network has amongst some people. But I explained to them what type of organization, you know, this is. It's about, you know, hard-hitting investigative journalism, in-depth reporting, human interest stories. And people, once I explain, I even, you know, direct them to the Al Jazeera website, and it seems that, you know, then they kind of soften a bit, and they're like, oh, okay, I didn't know that, I didn't know this. So I think that there's a learning curve with some people, but overall the support has been very overwhelming. It's been good. It's been positive for me.
I wanted to ask you if you had any reservations about working for Al Jazeera America.
No, I didn't at all. I have a lot of people, mentors in the television news business who, you know, of course I turned to, you know, when this opportunity presented itself. And I also did my own homework. But no, I was never cautious about it at all. I knew going in what I was getting into.
What would your message be to viewers who maybe initially are put off by the notion of watching a network with an Arabic name? I imagine some people maybe aren't even going to give the network a chance. Is there any way to attract viewers like that who otherwise might just say, Al Jazeera America, I'm not even going to try to watch that? What would you say to people like that?
Right. I understand there's a negative perception, but I believe the viewers who are on the fence just give Al Jazeera America a try. They just might be pleasantly surprised by what they see. As I mentioned, I joined the team because of AJAM's dedication to solid fact-based journalism, and that's something that I was taught back in college, and those are the principles that I stand by when I approach a story. So I think that if people at least give it a try, they could walk away with something more than what they thought initially. So I think that it's worth trying at least once.
What's your initial thought as a viewer? I'm sure you've been watching the network, the shows you're not even involved in, the prime time lineup. What do you think?
So far, I'm very, very impressed. One of my favorite programs on the network right now is America Tonight. And I have seen some really incredible storytelling. The series on the violence in Chicago has really caught my interest, as well as there's another report about the population, the prison population in New Orleans, and boy, was that, it was just very eye-opening on how they were able to really get inside the story. For example, on the Chicago story, the reporter was in a house with alleged gang members, and these members had their faces hidden with shirts, and they had these, you know, assault rifles and guns and weapons. And you know, I was just thinking like, wow, that just blew me away to be, you know, that close to the story is something else.
What are you hearing about the availability of the network? Are providers giving it to their viewers? And one other thing while you're answering that I would like to ask about, for instance, I'm a customer of one of the satellite providers, and it's not in HD on my television. What are you hearing about its availability around the country?
I'm hearing that this network is available in a little over 40 million homes across the country. I know that Al Jazeera America is still trying to work out some things with other cable providers. Other than that, you know, I have friends who, if they have Comcast and if they have the certain package with Comcast, then they can see the network. But then I have other people who are having problems because they don't have, you know, A, B, or C cable provider. When it comes to HD, it's funny you bring that up. I didn't notice right offhand, but I did have a couple friends tell me, like, is it going to be in HD? Because it looks now, it's not in HD. But I couldn't tell you what the plans are with that down the line.
Aside from the content, if you're used to watching HD television, it's a bit jarring and difficult to watch something that isn't in HD.
Mm-hmm.
BC Onali Iri, thank you and good luck.
All right, thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure talking to you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
No Lansing area bar has generated a buzz lately like the Hopcat in East Lansing. Lines have been common since its opening just over a week ago at Grove and Albert Streets. The road to becoming a successful craft beer entrepreneur and bar owner has been a circuitous one for Hopcat owner Mark Sellers. He dropped out of Michigan State to attend the Berklee College of Music in Boston and then pursued a career in music, but he returned to MSU later and graduated with a degree in accounting, and the rest is Michigan brewing history. Mark Sellers, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
You already own and operate a Hopcat in Grand Rapids, as well as a few other establishments over there. How did you end up opening a location here in East Lansing?
Well, I mean, it was just kind of a series of fortuitous events. I am a Spartan. I have been ever since I watched Magic Johnson and Greg Kelser win the national championship in 1979 when I was 10 years old. Always been a Spartan, and went to Michigan State. The guy who runs my operations for me, our COO of Barfly Ventures, went to Michigan State at the same time I did. Our president of our company lives in East Lansing and commutes to Grand Rapids, so we just had a lot of East Lansing connections. And the location right on the corner of Grove and Albert across from the 7-Eleven there is arguably one of the best, if not the best, location in, for a restaurant and bar in East Lansing. So all those things kind of came together at the same time, and I signed a lease about 9 months ago, and the rest is history.
Where'd you grow up, Mark?
I grew up in Grand Rapids, moved away for 20 years, lived in Boston, Los Angeles, and then Chicago for 10 years, and moved back to Grand Rapids from Chicago in 2007, and that's when I started Hopcat.
Now, describe your typical customer so far. Are they younger, older, male, female? How does it break out?
Well, so far it's very similar to the Grand Rapids demographic, even though we're right next to the campus and you might think it would be all college kids. It's not at all. We've had grandmas in there. We have had a lot of kids in there with their parents, so families. And we've also had a lot of college students, you know, the older college students later at night. So I'd say it's a very mixed crowd, which is, I think, different than most of the other places in East Lansing, and I'm kind of happy about that.
Beer became a real passion for you. How did that unfold exactly?
Well, when I lived in Chicago, I had gotten my degree in accounting from Michigan State. I got a job at GE, and that involved a lot of travel. And that was my first job after college. And when I traveled, I would always hit the local brewery or beer bar. I was kind of a craft beer fan. And I had an opportunity to just go to a lot of different places. And over the last 15 years, I've probably been to 1,000 breweries around the world, including Belgium, Germany, Scandinavia, and all over the United States, as well as a lot of beer bars. And so when the opportunity in Grand Rapids came up, I had never owned a bar, but I did know what makes a good brewery, what makes a good beer bar from a customer perspective. And I just hired somebody to kind of execute that plan for me. I came up with the concept, the name, the design, the interior design, and I let other people execute it for me, and it's worked out really well for me.
So if you were about to be, say, executed by firing squad, what pint of beer would you request as a final wish?
My go-to beer, my desert island beer, if I was stuck on a desert island and could only drink one the rest of my life, would be Short's Hooma Loompa-licious. It's an IPA. It's about 6.5% alcohol content, so a little bit higher than say, Budweiser, but a lot more taste. It's kind of bitter with a malty finish. After you swallow, you get a little bit of a sweet malty finish. It's just a great beer.
Now, you've taken some gas for the Playboy covers in the men's room. What's been your thought process on that? Are you confident this will just die down and go away? You stand by your decision? Have you rethought it? What?
I just think it's much to do about nothing. There's no nudity. It's just Playboy magazine. It's not even as racy as Maxim magazine that you see at every grocery store checkout. It's historic Playboy magazines from the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it's just a bathroom, you know. We actually have had pinup girls in the Hopcat Grand Rapids bathroom since the day we opened. We've only gotten one complaint in 6 years. So I think this Lansing thing is just much ado about nothing. It's just a bathroom.
And explain your connection to the Titanic, please. This sounds really interesting.
So I was in the financial business in Chicago. I had my own investment fund during the latter part of my time there, and it did pretty well, and we bought a stock among many that I had in my portfolio. My fund that I managed bought a stock called Premier Exhibitions, and Premier Exhibitions owns the Titanic shipwreck and exhibits the artifacts all over the world. In fact, the exhibit right now is in Grand Rapids. It was in Detroit last year. It's also always in Vegas and some other permanent locations. And in 2008,
2008, I was the my fund was the largest shareholder, and we didn't like the way the management team was running the company, so we waged a hostile proxy battle to kick out the existing management team. We won that in a landslide vote of shareholders, and the shareholders made me the chairman of the company, and I installed a new board of directors. And since then, we've turned it around. Now the company is profitable. And so, yeah, I'm still chairman of that company. It's very interesting. I never would have guessed 10 years ago that if someone had told me you would control the Titanic shipwreck later in your career, I would have thought they were smoking something. You know, I never in a million years would have dreamed that, but it's been a pretty interesting ride.
And you were you attended Berkeley in Boston, and you were a musician in California, correct?
Well, I was a musician in Michigan when I dropped out of Michigan State. All I wanted to do was play the piano and guitar. I'd never studied. So I shocked and horrified my parents by dropping out without telling them. And they found out when they got my report card, and I had a bunch of F's on it. And I then, to make them kind of happy that I was at least pursuing some education, went to school in Berklee School of Music after auditioning. I learned how to play jazz piano there. Then I moved out to Los Angeles to play in a rock and roll band, and we toured all over the country. Never really made it big, and eventually I decided to move back to East Lansing to finish my college degree. And I finished it in 1998 with an accounting major.
I was in the East Lansing Hopcat over the weekend. The portraits of the rock music icons are really unforgettable. Is that an idea of yours?
It is. Yeah, that was taken from a road trip that I did. I did a barbecue road trip, which means I was thinking about starting a barbecue restaurant in Grand Rapids, but I wanted to make it pretty authentic, and so I went to Kansas City, Memphis, St. Louis, Chicago, Nashville, North South Carolina, and just ate barbecue basically for 2 weeks in a row every meal. I gained about 15 pounds, but it was a great trip. And when I was in Nashville, I went to B.B. King's Blues Club, and there was art all over the walls from a particular artist named Lamar Sorrento, who I then Googled, and I found out that he is a pretty well-known artist down in that area. He's also a virtuoso guitar player, and he's actually more well-known for guitar than he is for his art, but I really liked his art, and I thought it would fit well at one of my bars. And so I waited a couple years to figure out which bar would kind of work for it. And this new Hopcat, I think it fits in nicely. So we had him paint everything.
I think the proprietors or the customers like it, I'm sure. Mark Sellers of the Hopcat in East Lansing and Grand Rapids, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, expert Frank Oakberg discusses hostage negotiations. Also, we preview the Wharton Center's upcoming season. That and more Wednesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.